I'd like to welcome all of you to the New York Society Library. My name is Jeanette Sanger, and I've been a trustee here for many years. And as you know, this is the oldest library in the city. This evening, our speaker, Elaine Cagle, will talk about her memoir, Why We Live, with Sarah Holliday, our events organizer, who needs no introduction to any memoirs. And she also sings beautifully. But I don't think she's going to be singing tonight. No. Gospel music, baby. Anyway, religion was very important to John Sharp, a missionary from Scotland who in 1710 came to the colonies, preached to the Iroquois, and accompanied British troops in maneuvers against the French. The mission of his life was to campaign for a public library in New York City. In those days, public library referred to subscription library, or anyone that paid a fee. The 1713 proposal Sharp discusses the urgent need of the city. There is hardly anything more wanted in this country than learning, there being no place I know of in America where it is either less encouraged or regarded. Sharp's collection of books relating to Christianity is one of the treasures of this library. Many of the books are in Latin, which very few people can read nowadays. Elaine Cagle is best known for research and publication involving a collection of over 50 ancient Greek texts discovered in Upper Egypt in 1945. After completing her doctorate at Harvard University, she participated with an international team of scholars to edit, translate, and publish several of these texts. I would imagine our Scottish missionary, John Sharp, might be shocked by some of Elaine's revelations. After publishing two monographs and several scholarly articles, she wrote the Gnostic Gospels, which won the National Book Award and the National Book Critics Circle Award. Then, having received the MacArthur Prize Fellowship, she joined the faculty of Princeton University in 1982. She continues to teach and do research there. She has published other books, including Beyond Belief, The Secret Gospel of Thomas, and most recently, Revelation, Vision, Prophecy, and Politics in the Book of Revelation. Elaine's latest book, Why Religion, has been published to rapturous reviews. Here are a few excerpts. One of PW's best books of the year, Searing and Wise, Tender and Wrenching, sketched with exquisite detail, Boston Globe. A wide-ranging work of cultural reflection and a brisk tour of the most exciting religion scholarship over the past 40 years, Washington Post. And there are many more. In Why Religion, Elaine writes about the devastating loss of her first child and then the death of her husband a year later. She interweaves this intensely personal story with the work she loves and how religious traditions have shaped how we understand ourselves and how we relate to one another. I have been fascinated and enlightened by Elaine's work during the last 20 years. Her friendship has been an inspiration. And now, let us welcome Elaine.
Couple of moments of business here. Yeah, somebody has spotted. We did squeeze in three more seats up at the front here. If there's anybody standing or whatever you want to squeeze through, thank you. Thank you for your patience in gathering into this room. As somebody said to me a few minutes ago, now we see why religion is still so important to all of us now because we were all squeezed into this room. If I could just ask you to silence cell phones or anything that might make a noise, that would be great too. So thank you, Jeanette, for introducing, and thank you so much, Dr. Cagle, for being with us this evening. I am sitting here because, yes, I'm the library's head of events, and I also write novels about the 1960s and do a variety of other strange things, but years ago I gained a degree in religion with an emphasis in New Testament studies at Oberlin College, and Elaine Pagels was one of my absolute heroes, so I beg for the chance to be the other person on the stage tonight, and I'll just be providing a little bit of prompting for Elaine speaking about the book. So, shall I plunge in?
Do. Okay. Let's plunge.
So you are a historian of religion, which is a very specific thing, but it's also a field that overlaps in subject matter with lots of other big fields and other people's practice of religion. Can you say just a little bit about what being a historian of religion is and is not?
Well, I'm glad you asked that, because a lot of people say, you're a theologian, right? And I say, no. Theologians talk about God. I talk about people and the cultures we create. You know, last semester at Princeton, I had so much fun because one of my colleagues, Jonathan Gold, knows little about Christianity and a lot about Tibetan Buddhism. He translates 11th century texts. And we taught a course together called Jesus and Buddha, which was a lot of fun. And in our department, we teach Islam and Judaism, Christianity, Hinduism, and there are three fine scholars of Buddhism. So there's plenty of opportunity to learn from each other. But it's cultural history, primarily. And it was often and is, in my case, motivated by questions that I wanted to ask anyway. Spiritual search, I have to admit.
So, question like, why religion, for instance, the title of your newest book? And in the past, your books have been wonderfully for a general audience and introduced some things that could otherwise be abstruse and scholarly, but they tend to be specific about the history of the idea of Satan or the Gospel of Thomas. Why religion is a little bit of an overview, as Jeanette suggested in the introduction, kind of involves a little bit of intellectual history. And I think also the question, why religion, applies in lots of ways to your personal story. So the question of why you would want to study religion, why religion in that sense?
Well, there's a lot of ways of talking about that. I mean, part of it was a question of the wonderful man I married in my 20s. Okay, I get too excited. You know, he said, why religion? Study something that has impacted the real world. And I said, well, why do you do elementary particle physics? I can't even see them. I mean, do they matter? And so we had some arguments about that. But also, because I was brought up in a family that was culturally Protestant, and really religion was very peripheral. My father had given it up for Darwin and became a biologist and thought, these are silly old folk tales, there's nothing to it. And nobody would be interested in it if they had half a brain or if they knew anything about science. So that's the kind of snobbish attitude I grew up with. But then I got hit by it as an adolescent in a way that would have been embarrassing to talk about. It was kind of embarrassing to talk about it. A lot of evangelical critics of my work called me Elaine Pagan. So to start the book at a Billy Graham crusade when I was 14 was really not what they expected. And I didn't either. I just ended up there that day because it was more interesting than being in Palo Alto, which is pretty boring. And San Francisco was always more interesting. But anyway, what happened was I had a sense of the power of these traditions, the power of the imagination, the music, how these traditions speak less, as far as I'm concerned. People think it's about what do you believe in God, do you believe in Jesus? Yeah. That's all part of it, but that's not what I find most compelling about these traditions, whether it's Buddhism or Judaism or Islam. They're emotionally powerful. The rituals and the songs and the liturgies and the passions that they arouse are very much part of these different cultures. And studying Jesus and Buddha, I was just bowled over by how weird Buddhism was to me, because the culture is so different. So that's a programmatic question. And some of my friends recently said, well, yeah, but you don't really answer the question. Why is religion still around in the 21st century? But that's a question I've been asking myself ever since. I thought, was it Christianity that hit me so powerfully, or would it be any religion, or what is it? I think it's, for me, it's mainly about the imagination. It's about how we understand ourselves and imagine ourselves in the stories and the songs and the poems and the, you know, the rituals, you know, whether it's Passover or Christmas or whatever these rituals are, and the way we people live their lives through them. It's kind of a pattern, you know. I compared it in the book to the first time I had that experience, I think, was reading The Wizard of Oz. And then I could live in a world in which, you know, I was Dorothy, and there was Toto, and there was the Tin Man, and the Straw Man, and all of that. And you're living in that world, it becomes a paradigm. And Jesus and Satan were like that when I was born again for at least a year.
Can I just brag that I had that with The Wizard of Oz also? Do I need the mic?
What did I do to the mic?
I want to throw in one more thing from your early years before you became a scholar of religion and were somewhat on the music scene in Northern California, I think.
Oh, well, that's a story I told because it was how I actually left that evangelical church after a year. A friend of mine was in an automobile accident, and he was 16, he was in high school as I was, and was killed in an automobile accident, but it was also an accident in which Jerry Garcia was thrown out the front window and just blew through the whole window with his shoes taken off, and his friend Alan broke his back and was thrown out the other way, and it was part of a group we had a bunch of Maverick friends then. And one of the wonderful things about it, about writing this book, I did an interview with Terry Gross, and then to my surprise, I got a letter from Alan Trist, who I haven't seen since then, since high school, and he was Jerry's best friend, Jerry Garcia's best friend. His father was visiting Stanford as a scholar at the Center for Democratic Institutions for Cambridge University, and Alan was in high school, and he fell out with this crowd of motley people playing music with Jerry Garcia and doing other things like that. And so his father said, oh, now after all this happened, you have to go back. You have to go back to Cambridge University and get your degree, which he did, in anthropology. And I just got this letter from him saying, and then immediately after getting his degree, he went back and became the manager of the Grateful Dead for 25 years. to his parents. Huge dismay. And I got this letter from him saying, wow. He said, your book, The Gnostic Gospels, I read it, and it saved me from the murky waters of Roman Catholicism. And he said, but I didn't know it was you because you had then gotten married and you changed your name. And it was, I didn't know it was Elaine. So anyway, we're going to talk about it because he's going to write the definitive book, I think, because he lives to tell the tale of what happened in all those years, which I'd like to hear a lot more about.
Thank you for indulging me on that one. So then you had become a rebel because you were hanging out with the future Grateful Dead. So that set you up then to, I'm joking, but to discover the Gnostic Gospels and the discoveries of the ancient texts that had been very unknown in the traditional circles up to that time. So what drew you to them, and why are they important?
Well, I decided after I came to New York to study dance, and I didn't know anything because I grew up in California, except about dance, what was going on here. I mean, everything was going on here, but I didn't know that, because my teacher knew Martha Graham, and her husband's name was Erica Hawkins. Anyway, so that's all I knew. So I came to on 63rd Street, there was a studio to be a dancer. And it was wonderful, except that I found out I was not good enough. I was pretty good, but In New York, that didn't mean anything. I would be waiting on tables. So I decided I wasn't that much a devotee. And I wanted to go back and find out, what was it about that experience that was so powerful, this thing with religion? So I went back to find out, what do we really know about Jesus anyway? And how did that movement start? It's such such a weird story to start a world religion about this man that's crucified and killed by his enemies. I mean, how does that turn into what it turned into? And then I was just overjoyed to find out that my professors had file cabinets full of gospels I've never heard of, like the Gospel of Thomas and the Gospel of Mary Magdalene and the Gospel of Peter and the Gospel of Philip and the Gospel of Judas and the Gospel of Truth and 50 other ancient texts written in Greek like the New Testament with dialogues between Jesus and various people, supposedly. What do you make of that? We had an opportunity to find out, and this stuff was all heresy, right? And the bishops had burned and destroyed it. And that in itself was a huge puzzle. So we didn't know, what is this stuff? We got the chance to translate it and think about it, and then try to think, why was it all buried like that? And why did the bishops find it so dangerous?
Well, one element of that might be, but feel free to contradict me, it might tie in with one of my favorite elements of why religion, also very much a theme of your really iconic book, The Gnostic Gospels, is the rediscovery of women's voices and roles in early Christian communities that then got minimized by other narratives. Can you talk a little bit about why that aspect of this history has stuck with you and been meaningful for you? Despite the continued misogyny, let's face it, of so much organized religion?
Oh, well, yes, it was a surprise to find out that that was part of the story of the early movement. That, you know, some people will say, well, this stuff sounds kind of New Age. And I'd think, well, you know, 2,000 years is not that new. We didn't make it up. But what I love about these texts, when I read the Gospel of Thomas, and I came across this saying, you know, I always go back to it, saying 70, in which Jesus says, if you bring forth what is within you, what you bring forth will save you. If you do not bring forth what is within you, what you do not bring forth will destroy you. And I thought, wow, you don't have to believe that. It just happens to be true, you know? And there are other sayings like that. And these sources, these sayings, are experiential. They're not dogma. They're not doctrine. It's not about believe in this, believe in that at all. It's about you know, the human condition and how we understand it. And what it suggests is that, see, I took that psychologically about people hiding within themselves what they can't really say until they find their voice. And it could work on that level, but I realized it was also a theological statement, because the Gospel of Thomas suggests that every human being, all beings, are created in the image of God, in the divine image, and the image is simply a metaphor for the energy that brought us all into being. And it suggests that everyone here can find a way back to the divine source, because you have access within yourself if you look for it. So the bishops thought, you know, that's not something you really want. If you're setting up a universal church and saying, outside the church there is no salvation, right? You can't get there unless you come to our church, because it has a monopoly on access to God, and that's only through Jesus Christ. And anyone who's not in that part of that game is not, you know, is eternally damned. Well, that's what happened in the 4th century. And that's when they said these texts should all be destroyed, because I think they suggested you didn't need a church, you didn't need Jesus, you didn't need an institution, you could get there. And that's one thing I love about them.
See, I wasn't kidding about the rebel thing. There we go. Mm-hmm. So one of the loveliest images in Why Religion is the surprise appearance at a funeral of your friend from a Trappist monastery. And you had had a relationship with them as a visitor and a teacher for some time by that point, I think, talking about some of the same material. Can you talk a little bit about why that resonated with that group and how you came to know them?
Well, I came to know the Trappist monks. It's a Catholic order, 1,000 years old, Cistercians, from a Jewish musician whom I loved very much, Robert Mann. He founded the Juilliard Quartet, and I met him in Aspen when I was just out of graduate school, and Bobby was already very famous. And the quartet, the Juilliard, was playing Beethoven's 132 quartet once when we walked into the music tent. Fabulous. I never heard anything quite like the way they played it that day. And Bobby had said he was invited to become their first Jewish monk. And he brought music to the monastery because the monks could go to his concerts. So he invited a few friends, including my husband and me. My husband was somebody he used to climb mountains with. So they invited us up to the monastery, and we met the monks. And it was a very powerful and beautiful place. It's way up in the mountains, 5,000 acres the monks have. It's about 10,000 feet, very beautiful and very secluded. And there's a deep well of silence and spirituality there that, even though I sort of have a kind of cultural Protestant apprehension about Catholicism and some of its attitudes, I came to love those monks in that place. And they were great. Still are.
Yeah, the Gospel of Thomas got in there.
Well, yeah, Thomas Keating asked me to come and talk to the monks about the Gospel of Thomas. And I said, well, I won't talk about it, I'll just give it to you. So I Xeroxed. It's only 15 pages. I gave it to them and asked them what they thought. And they really liked it. And this year, this last summer, the abbot Joseph asked me to come and talk about something else. So I talked about the Gospel of Truth, which is a text that I'm sort of falling in love with. And I read about it a little in the book. I'm writing an article about it now, a scholarly article. And I wondered what these monks would think about this heretical myth. And they really loved it, which I like a lot. But I wanted to translate scholarly work into work that anyone interested in the subject could read. Because my husband's friends were mostly either artists or scientists, and they thought religion was really weird. And I wanted to say, no, this is really exciting material. So that's why I wrote these other books, and I loved doing that.
One of the other things I loved in Why Religion was the description of the partnership between you, Dr. Pagels, scholar of religion, and Dr. Heinz Pagels, who was a physicist, as you mentioned already. And I was also delighted to find out that the library has three of Heinz's books in our collection. So both of you seem to be people who are very deeply in the scholarship of your own very specific fields, but also have this capacity to share it with the general audience. Was that a happy writing partnership?
Well, it was a very lucky marriage. It was wonderful. And it, you know, I just know from that how wonderful it can be when you are really madly in love with someone. And I also know it can happen more than once. So it's marvelous. It was great. We didn't write together very much, but you know, I wrote the Gnostic Gospels. He wrote the Cosmic Code. He's supposed to write the Gnostic Code or the Cosmic Gospels, start our own religion, but we never got to that. Become a sort of TV evangelist.
I think there's still time for the Cosmic Gospels. Yeah, that could come out any day now. We could really use it. So it seemed to me, reading Why Religion, that a major part of the book is, in a way, its own biography of your oldest child, Mark, who was diagnosed with a rare and invariably fatal illness soon after his birth. And I thought it was just beautiful and wonderful to read about how good and full and fun a life Mark had, although he lived only 6 years. And it got me thinking of something that a friend had shared with me. A while back, Emily Rapp wrote for the New York Times, "I will never be a tiger mom. The mothers and fathers of terminally ill children are something else entirely. Our goals are simple and terrible: to help our children live with minimal discomfort and maximum dignity. This requires a new ferocity, a new way of thinking, a new animal. We are dragon parents, she says, fierce and loyal and loving as hell. Would you tell us a little bit about Mark and why religion was and was not useful to you during the time you were a dragon parent?
Oh, well, that was hard, very hard. And it drew me back to some of the music of the Church of the Heavenly Rest and other aspects of it. But after he died, I must say, people say, oh, your faith must sustain you. And I don't know what you're talking about. I had never felt further from any faith than after that. That was desolation. But I wrote about it because I had to put it way out of my mind after what happened. And then, you know, my husband's death in a mountain accident. He was at Rockefeller University here at the time. I just could not deal with that stuff because we had then, after Mark's death, adopted two babies, one 3-month-old and one 2 at the time that Heinz died. So I was just shattered. It was the only word I could think of. What was I going to say then? It was a long time before I started thinking about those things again. But the work of the study of religion became a kind of yoga, a way of exploring things. I write here about the Gospels of the New Testament and why the Gospel of Mark, in its original form without the happy ending, spoke to me very deeply, because that's kind of the way, that's the world I was living in. Also, because I couldn't process this at the time. And I realized, too, that that's one kind of loss that many people who have it don't talk about, because it's just too awful for other people to deal with, usually. And if I hadn't had that experience and you said something like that to me, I would say, oh, I'm so sorry. But now I would say, oh, so what happened? Because if somebody says that, they're opening a conversation that many people don't want to have, and I'm not afraid to have it now. It's 25 years later, 30 years later, so only now would I even go near that. But what I wrote about, and what the surprise of it, I didn't want to write about losses, because everyone here has losses. That's not news, and it's not something we necessarily have to talk about that way. It was the surprise that it's 25 years later and I, can have a joyful life. That's the surprise, that to be able to live through something you think you can't possibly live through. And I'm sure many people have that experience.
Yeah, that's an extremely resonant thing. So, I think you've spoken to this a little bit already, but I just want to tease it out a little bit. This question of why religion, and obviously if you're working as a scholar of religion, continuing the scholarly work through some of this period, as you say, is its own practice, which was perhaps helpful. But did you find that people said to you after Mark's death and Heinz's death, how could you possibly be focusing on religion at a time like this? Why does that continue to be important to you as a scholarly study, as a thing of interest? The phrase Job's friends comes to mind. I think it may be in the book somewhere. No, it may be in some other book I read recently somewhere. Anyway, maybe you had better friends than Job did. I don't know. And also kind of, so you study primarily Christianity and of course then Judaism, element of that study. Do you think there are any other traditions that do well or better with loss?
Well, yes, I do, actually. I think that the Buddhist, I mean, well, the Hebrew Bible says, you know, we wouldn't die, we wouldn't have pain, we wouldn't have oppression or anything bad if we hadn't done something bad. Somebody did something wrong. And, you know, that doesn't make sense to me in terms of biology. I mean, you know, the kind of creatures we are we get born and we die, and that's not about Adam sinning or anything like that. But this whole story pretends that it's somebody's fault if something happened. And that's one of the things I really had to write about. Because you know how when somebody dies that you love, you can think, well, why did I let him go on that plane? Or why didn't I stop him from climbing mountains or something, as if I could have? Or why didn't I do that? And of course, it's as though we think we could make a difference. And if we could have made a difference, you know, somebody, one of my dearest friends said the day after Mark died, if you could have done anything to prevent it, you would have, right? Well, that's pretty elementary and obvious. And the fact is that so much of the things that happen and the losses we deal with, we're helpless. And I realized that feeling guilty about it, and parents of children, I mean, look, if you're a parent, your main job is to keep your child alive, right? And so if you can't do that, it feels like a failure, more than even other kinds of loss. And yet, I realized that that sense of guilt about why didn't we, was hiding something worse, hiding something that was more painful than guilt. And that's the reality of it. And the reality of it was we were totally helpless. There was nothing we could do. Nothing we could do. And it was more acceptable to think we had negative input than to realize the truth, which is there was nothing we could do. And that's really unacceptable. It's very painful, but it's also very grounding. And I realized at the time that I had chosen unconsciously to feel guilty rather than helpless. This isn't particular to Christians or Jews. You know, in the Hebrew Bible, I was reading a story about David and Bathsheba, right? And, you know, King David had Bathsheba's husband put in the front line of the army so he would get killed so he could marry Bathsheba. And then the story says that she got pregnant and had a baby boy. And the Lord smote the baby because of the sin of David and Bathsheba. So it was their illicit sex that meant that the baby died. So if the baby died, it must be because something they did wrong. Now that's just typical of the Hebrew Bible, of the Christian story, and of the Hopi religion, and also of many others. I kind of like the Buddhist awareness that life involves suffering, and it's not anybody's fault necessarily. It's just the nature of the species, and you know, and that joy is kind of a miracle in all of that. So it's a very different, and I just felt it was a more grounded perspective.
Thank you. So the last thing I wrote on my little cheat sheet here is kind of a re-emphasis of the value of this title, Why Religion? And it seemed to me that it has a question mark on the cover of the book, but it also works a little bit as a noun, that some of what is going on here is a why religion, as opposed to a because religion. Is that something that resonates with you?
Yes, I mean, and one of my friends complained that I hadn't answered the question. Sorry about that. But there are so many, it was a programmatic question. It was a question that motivates the work. And there are many ways of answering it. I mean, you can talk about sociologically and culturally how these traditions, whether Jewish or Buddhist or Muslim or Hindu, convey cultural values, how they transmit the culture's sense of what it means to be human and what kind of work we should do and what men do and what women do. The creation stories are all about that. Very practical issues. And it's also important for me, and when I teach, to say, yeah, but do we agree with that? I mean, do we agree with the Hebrew Bible's assessment of, say, what men do and what women do? For example, I mean, it's maybe time to raise questions about that, as many people are. And to be aware of how we're shaped by the culture and choose to what extent we say yes or no to any of that stuff. That's part of it. But also, I don't know, I don't, some people think that everybody needs religion, and I think that's very imperialistic. I don't think my husband needed it that way. For him, physics was the way he related to the universe and loved it. For many people here, it's going to be something else. It may be art, it may be painting, it may be taking care of people, it may be trying to make a difference in the culture. But I do think that for many of us, the imagination, one of my dear friends, James Cone, who is a theologian, he said he's a theologian, and you asked him, so what is theology? He said, well, we make it up. It's about imagination. It's about how we interpret the world. And we don't just make it up from nothing, we make it up from our cultural traditions, and we try to speak to it. But these are ways that we do look for meaning, and that's part of it. But there are so many different ways to answer that. I never pretended I could answer the question, but I still ask it, and I still find it fascinating.
I think that the pagan writer Starhawk had a similar thing that somebody said, but you know, contemporary paganism is so new, where do you get your rituals? And she said, just the same as every other religion, we make them up. So what else would you like to talk about, or shall we have some discussion with the audience?
Why don't we just open it up?
Great. Who's got a question?
So you sort of came to Buddhism, I guess, as a way to deal with the self. But isn't Buddhism that, doesn't Buddha have a metaphysical aspect to that, you know, about after death and did not speak about it? There is a metaphysical aspect to it. Do you question something about that?
Oh, yes. I really didn't come to Buddhism because of those losses. I just got interested in my colleagues' work. And this tradition, which I really wanted to study, but I didn't do it in graduate school because by then I realized that unless you work with the languages, you really don't connect with the culture very well. And I was struggling with Hebrew and Greek and Coptic, and I couldn't do Sanskrit or Tibetan or Chinese or any of those languages, which I wish I could. So, yeah, they have many metaphysical aspects, I guess. I mean, I don't know enough about Buddhism. I'm still learning about it. I'm not saying I prefer it. It's just that my culture, I'm dealing with how I was brought up and how this culture impacted us. I'm not sure.
Well, there's this further question, a metaphysical question, okay? Yeah, with
which question are you
thinking? They asked him about life after death. You know, and he didn't want to talk about it. He didn't say it doesn't exist. It seems like there are things that he didn't want to talk about, but that he thought existed. And I'm just wondering, how the more metaphysical stuff, how do you relate to that?
Well, I should know more about it, but what I remember when my husband was director of the New York Academy of Science on 63rd Street, the Dalai Lama asked him if he would get a gathering of scientists to talk with him. So they did. And he said, you really ought to come. And I said, I've got to teach my class. So I didn't go. But there were all these scientists, and they had a wonderful discussion. But at one point, they asked about reincarnation. And the Dalai Lama said, well, look, you people don't study this. We have evidence of it. We have ways of identifying people who have had previous lives, like the Buddhas supposedly had 1,000 previous lives, maybe more. And he said, yeah, we know about this. You're just ignorant of it. So that was what he said. I don't really know what the Buddha would have said. But it's a very, important question. I don't have an answer for it.
Mm-hmm.
if I heard you correctly, you said somewhere along the during the most difficult time of your life, that coming to the point where you could accept the fact that you were helpless helped make you more grounded. That seemed like such a deep idea to me, and I'm wondering if you could say a word about that.
Yeah, well, it's that sense of feeling like you failed because, you know, you couldn't keep that person alive.
What does grounded
mean? Well, it just meant it settled me down. You know, it's like, okay, that's the real truth. I don't have to struggle with emotional stress about it in the way that I did. I mean, it's hard enough to deal with grief, but if you add to that guilt, hey, that's a whole lot worse. And so I kind of had to let go of that. And so grounded was just sort of the relief of allowing that recognition, even though it's kind of painful. Yeah, thank you for that question.
I'm just a little curious about why you would look to Buddhism when the Judeo-Christian texts, they're so complex. It seems like you could find support for so many different ways of thinking. You could look at Job, he didn't do anything wrong, you know, or Ecclesiastes or something like that.
Well, exactly. And actually in the book, I don't talk much about Buddhism because, as I say, I don't know much about it. I'm just learning. But in the book, what I struggled with and worked with and played with were the texts of the New Testament Gospels and also the Book of Job. The Book of Job, just turn it around and struggle with it and fight with it, argue with it. It's an extraordinary condensed poem and story that, you know, we love these stories because they speak to us about issues that we struggle with. So yes, that's how I work with it, exactly.
Yeah. You asked a question, why religion, with profound respect for the interplay between religion and culture and helping us to understand our lives. I'm wondering if your students are like my children, who are millennials, who ask the question, why religion, with a lot of cynicism?
Well, yeah, my children don't have much use for it now.
Yeah.
It's funny, I just got a letter from a friend who said, you know, after his bar mitzvah, he just said, hey, I'm
done.
That's
it.
And now it's quite a bit later, and he said, suddenly I thought when I read your book, he said, well, I thought there was a lot of hypocrisy, a lot of showing off on the holy days. Who needs that?
Yeah.
He didn't need it. He's a law professor at Harvard. He didn't need it. And he said, now I'm asking, why not? And one thing I find about participating in religious rituals and the music and the poetry and immersing myself in this stuff is that I was thinking how some people go into despair, right, from whatever happens to them in their life. I saw it happen to my mother-in-law, who was a very lovely, beautiful woman. And she was from a long line of Lutheran pastors, my husband's mother. And she'd given all up religion. She was a rationalist, you know, music, opera, but, you know, philosophy, but religion, no. And she just broke when these things happened. And I understood that very well, all too well. But there were no resources. And I grew up in a culture in California, in Palo Alto, academic family, scientists, and all that. There were very few resources to deal with death. And so I thought, you know, when I walked into the Church of the Heavenly Rest, when our son was diagnosed, accidentally, it was a cold day like this in the winter, and we just gotten this diagnosis, and I was running around the reservoir in Central Park. And it was so cold, I stopped in it. The church was warm, and it was open, and it happened to be a Sunday morning, which I hadn't thought about. And suddenly there was this music, you know, this amazing music, and I thought, wow, I could actually come here on purpose. And what I find is that Clifford Geertz, the anthropologist who used to be at the Institute for Advanced Study,
was studying Balinese cremation rituals, and he said the work of culture is to make suffering sufferable. And I thought, well, that's part of it. You could also, it's also to celebrate. Right? The work of culture also helps us celebrate. But I do think that those rituals, those poems, those stories, like the story of Passover, which is a story about coming out of slavery into freedom, the story of Christmas, the story of Easter, these are very familiar to most of us, whether we're religious or not. These are stories that move toward hope. And that's what these traditions often do. And sometimes you think, really? Does that make any sense? Do I really believe that? You know, but they actually do sometimes have the capacity to sustain hope when otherwise there's no rational reason to have it. So I think that's a very major part of why they survive. Not just about beliefs, but about the way we feel.
You found any cultures that have no religion?
Pardon me?
Have you found or been able to study any cultures that have no form?
Not that I know of, have you? Has anyone? I mean, and you'd think, well, you know, if you were like my father and you'd say, well, look, it's just bad science, really. You know, the world wasn't created in 6 days, you know. You wouldn't need it if that's what it was. But that's not what it is, you know. It's about how we interpret our lives. So I don't think there is a culture that doesn't do that with poems, with music, with rituals, with songs and stories.
Yeah. It seems like a lot of cultures have a lot of things, and a lot of religions that have existed throughout history have a lot of things in common, and one of the most useful tools is the allegory, and that helps us to adapt to our stresses and strains in life, and that seems like a really relevant, practical aspect of it, no matter what you believe. I mean, to me, it's all a big mystery, and I never will know any more than I know, but the allegories are helpful.
Yes, I think it's really important, because it's a kind of peculiarly American custom to read things literally. The creation story, do you think that's meant to be taken literally? 2,000 years ago, or 3 or 4? I mean, that's weird. Probably not. I mean, American fundamentalism, you know, in the beginning of the 20th century, set the stage for a lot of American attitudes about religion. But if you read the rabbis, and if you read the fathers of the church, they're reading metaphor, they're reading poetry. And I think of it, I always think of these religious traditions the way Marianne Moore talks about poetry. She says, poetry is imaginary gardens with real toads in them. And I thought, these stories have real toads in them. You know? Like the story of David and Bathsheba, a baby dies. That does happen. And in the ancient world, it happened very often. So it speaks to that. But the stories aren't meant to be taken literally. They're meant to speak to the way we interpret things. Exactly. So I'm really glad you mentioned that.
I read your book, Adam and Eve and the Serpent, because on the Sunday bulletin, the Episcopal priest said, whatever you do, do not read this book.
Who said that?
This was an Episcopal priest
really?
In New York.
Oh, wow. Not one that I know.
But I wondered, why is it that your work would be viewed as threatening versus enlightening?
Because so many people have been indoctrinated with the idea that you have to take it literally. That's why they call me Elaine Pagan. It's because, you know, I'm teaching people not to take it that way. You know? So that's threatening to a lot of, there are a lot of Christians who've never taken it literally. It's always been songs and stories and poems and ways of speaking about release, right? Like the Exodus story. So at Passover, everybody says, all of us should be like the people who've come out of Egypt, and everyone comes out of Egypt, and so forth. And it's a ritual that talks about moving toward freedom, whatever that might mean to that particular person at that particular moment. Literal freedom from slavery, freedom from other kinds of bondage and captivity, the story of resurrection, the story of a miraculous birth of a baby. I got a recent email about, do I really think that Jesus was born of a virgin? I said, well, that has nothing to do with anything, I believe. I remember sitting around a table at Union Seminary when I was first came out of graduate school, and I was invited by the head of my professional society, a very distinguished scholar, Raymond Brown. Actually, Raymond Brown reviewed my book in the New York Times. And the good news was I was just out of graduate school, and my book was reviewed on the front page of the Sunday New York Times. And the bad news is it was reviewed by a major scholar of religion, senior scholar, highly respected, of Bible. And he said, this stuff was rubbish in the first century, it's still rubbish. He said that. And he said, well, she's a pretty good scholar, but this is deceiving the public because this text has nothing to do. Anyway, he was also a Supplician priest dedicated to the preservation of orthodoxy and religion. And the editor of the New York Times had no clue because he was teaching at Union Seminary. And I guess he thought he was a Protestant. But but I was sitting around a table with Raymond Brown because he thought, you have to have a woman in these discussions. And I was the only one who'd written a book published by a professional society, so he thought I was okay. And the book was about Mary, the mother of Jesus. And there were these 12 scholars, all men, Protestants and Catholics. And they were all talking about how Mary became pregnant. And I thought, I just can't laugh. Anyway, that's what I mean by literal. And I think there are plenty of good reasons why that story is told that way in Luke and Matthew. Because in Mark, Jesus is said to be the son of Mary. And that's not what you would call a Jewish boy if he had a legitimate father. So Matthew creates a genealogy and a husband for Mary, which Mark doesn't have. And Luke creates a different genealogy for the same man. Both of them going back to King David to make Jesus certifiably royal. So it works pretty well, and it's a wonderful story. But do I take it literally? I hope I'm not offended, but I don't. Yeah, why the controversy about the Gnostic Gospels? I got hate mail, a lot of it. I put it in a big cardboard box, and then I lost it. And also praise, because many people felt the way my friend Alan Twist did when he said, wait a minute, suddenly I realized that there was a lot we didn't know about the early Christian movement, and this answers some of the questions that I had growing up, like, what else didn't we know? And this is very liberating to realize that there were other texts, that there were other sources, and now there are many more of them. And I think I'd love to write a book about how would the development of the Christian movement look if we really add those texts and see that maybe even Paul had read the Gospel of Thomas. I don't know if he did or not, but he quotes one of the sayings in his letter. I don't know, it's pretty strange. But many people, like Raymond Brown, thought, wait a minute, you're saying that these Gospels should be considered like the New Testament? Really? Those are the right ones, and these are the bad ones. You know, those are the real Gospels, and these are the fake Gospels. Well, how do you get that idea? You get it from the fathers of the church, who said, look, there are authentic Gospels, and there's heresy. And all these were denounced as heresy in the second century by Bishop Irenaeus, one of my favorite characters, and who said, the heretics say they have more gospels than there really are. but really they have no gospels that are not full of blasphemy. And one of them is the gospel of truth, and one of them is the gospel of Thomas. And they say they have the gospel of the Hebrews and all this other stuff. Well, it's all nonsense, because there are only four. And why, if you ask Irenaeus, he says in book 3 of 5 volumes written against the heretics, because there were a lot of Christians who didn't believe it that way. Why? Because he said, well, there are four corners of the universe, and there are four principal winds, and therefore there can only be four gospels. So it makes perfect sense. You know, there are four pillars that hold up the sky, so there are four gospels that hold up the truth, and that's why. And so it's a scientific explanation.
Nice.
So that really offends people who were shaken by the idea that maybe what you find in the New Testament didn't just drop from heaven, it was written by somebody. So now we're studying it as if it was literature. I mean, we also study it, a lot of us, as if it were inspired, some of it anyway.
And I think it's interesting. If you really believe something or respect something, why do you feel it's threatening to have someone ask a different question? You had a different perspective. And I found it so fascinating because I hadn't really heard enough of that one. And I could not figure out why when someone is opening up a whole new realm of possibilities. If I were really a devout believer in a creed, I wouldn't understand why that would be threatening and not provocative.
Well, it is still threatening. If you look among scholars today, I mean, all over the world, people are working on these texts, you know, from everywhere in the world, Asia, Africa, China, not so much China, they don't do that so much in universities, but all over the world, people study these texts. And there's two different views. One is that these are really interesting and they add to what we know about the early Christian movement. And I'm in that camp. And the others, like Simon Gathercole at the University of Cambridge, where Alan Trist went to school, have written massive monographs to show that the Gospel of Truth, Thomas, is just very derivative. There's nothing original about it. It's worthless, really, because it's not one of the real Gospels. Because there's something about sacred scripture and getting it right and the Bible being true at a different level of anything else being true, right? A different quality of truth. Well, okay, they may be for people here. They may be for any of us. But the question I would ask is, do you find them that way or don't you? But see, then you take, see, every question is about authority. And so many people think religion is a bunch of answers to a bunch of questions. And I think it's a lot of questions. But if you think it's a lot of answers to a lot of questions, then, you know, this stuff is really what you don't want to read.
Do you believe in heaven? And if you do, what is it for you?
Oh, that's a great question. I don't know.
Could you repeat the question?
Do you believe in heaven? And if so, what is it for you? I don't know. Of course, when you deal with loss, you think about death. Where do they go? Are they somewhere? Are they present somewhere else? So I think about those questions. And I've had, experiences. See, when I started this, even when our son died, I had this rationalist conviction, assumption, that when people die, the molecules disperse and it's, as Steve Jobs put it, lights out, you know, that that's all. And I've had experiences in those times which totally confounded that conviction. So I don't know what to make of them. You know, they're powerful. So I'm hoping that there is. I would love that. I'd love to see those people again. I'll hope for that. But I don't know. And if anybody does, please let me know. Oh, and another, yeah.
I'd love for you to just talk a little bit about the problem
some of the texts from Nakamata, you mean?
Well, I'm thinking of there's a relatively new translation by, I can't remember, but this is terrible, the name of the author, but teaches at Notre Dame, and a translation of the New Testament. And it was one of the most extraordinary things I've ever read, because the rhythms, it's supposed to be the most literal translation that exists.
Oh, interesting.
And you begin to read this, and just in terms of a somatic experience, even within the body, if you're talking about it poetically, it totally shifts the relationship that you have to this text. It becomes much more immediate. One understands things about why, perhaps, the sense of apocalyptic urgency is there that was so grasped. So I don't know, as a translator,
Well, yes, that's why reading those languages is so wonderful. I don't know somebody who translated the New Testament at Notre Dame, but Robert Alter at Berkeley just translated the whole of the Hebrew Bible. And he's a brilliant translator, and he knows poetry, and he knows the rhythms of it. His translation of the Hebrew Bible is phenomenal. So that's great. I love that. Although
I'll have to get you the name.
Okay. But let me say something. I'd like to go back to the issue you raised, because one thing I decided to do in this book, which was a hard decision, was write about things I couldn't explain. I was having tea with Marie Howe, who's a poet laureate of New York, and she wrote a beautiful poem. She's raised Catholic. She wrote a beautiful poem about the angel Gabriel appearing to Mary, and Mary has this sense of overpowering love. It's called Annunciation. You know the poem? And I said, Marie, that's such an amazing poem. How did you write that? And she said, oh, well, it happened to me. I had that experience. But of course, I couldn't say that. And I said, why not? And she said, well, that's the last taboo, to suggest you have a religious experience. So yes, I had experiences that confounded the rationalism that I was brought up with, that suggested that there are more breaks and gaps and surprises in the universe than the rationalists ever imagined. And I don't know what to make of them. Some sense that, yes, somebody's speaking that who has died. Many people have those experiences. What do you make of them? I don't entirely know, but I know they happen. So that's another aspect of it, that rationalism is confounded by things that we actually experience sometimes, if we allow them, those experiences to emerge. So thank you for raising those questions.
Thank you so much. This has just been fantastic. We have copies of Why Religion for sale.